Welcome to Writer's Digest Presents. Hosted by the editors of Writer's Digest, this monthly podcast features conversations with writing and publishing experts whose insights will help ignite your creative vision, hone your skills, build your platform, and get your work out into the world. Welcome to Writer's Digest Presents. I'm Editor-in-Chief Amy Jones, alongside Editor Michael Woodson. Today we are joined by novelist and journalist Wob Gijig Rice. Wob is the author of Moon of the Crusted Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves, two books that I cannot stop thinking about. Wob, thanks so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Hi, Amy and Michael. Thanks a lot for having me. Real pleasure to be with you today.
Yeah. Before we get into our questions and discussions, could you give our listeners sort of a summary of what Moon of the Crusted Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves are about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Moon of the Crescent Snow is a post-apocalyptic story of sorts about a Anishinaabe community in far northern Ontario that experiences a sudden blackout, a loss of electricity, telecommunications, etc. And because this community is so far north, somewhat isolated, it's not an immediate crisis for them because there's still some land-based skills that are thriving in the community, like hunting and harvesting from the land and so on, right? But as the weeks go on, you know, things start to unravel slowly because there are no answers about the blackout or no contact whatsoever with the world to the south. And then that tension sort of ramps up a bit when an unexpected visitor arrives on a snowmobile from the city to the south, and then he's followed by some others. And that sort of upsets the balance in the community a little more, and the community members are forced to make some tough decisions. So, you know, we see, you know, a power struggle. But ultimately, what we also find are, rediscoveries of the land, reconnections with it, opportunities for renewal, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, all that comes to a head. And at the end of the story, the community finds itself in a newer place, not to give too much away for listeners who haven't read it yet. So Moon of the Turning Leaves picks back up in this new place that they've settled in 10 years after the end of Moon of the Crescent Snow, which is 12 years after the initial blackout. And the community discovers that a lot of the natural resources around them are starting to deplete. And they recognize that traditionally as Anishinaabe people, they would have been migratory according to season, according to food supply and so on. And they figure it's finally time to move on. You know, there have been some failed expeditions to the south and other directions to, you know, find answers after the blackout, but those were largely unsuccessful. So finally they decide, you know, it's time to make a larger quest to the south. And they also recognize that, you know, they don't have any answers, so they have to see what's going on. And also, the community's history is one of displacement. They're originally from the north shore of Lake Huron, and they've been displaced to far northern Ontario. So ultimately, they want to see if they can go home, if they can resettle, and if a mass exodus is in fact possible. So there's an exploratory mission of about six people who go on this quest over the course of a summer. And yeah, that's both books in a nutshell.
Moon of the Crusted Snow was published in 2018, which was well before the pandemic of 2020. And your books aren't necessarily pandemic novels. And I want to say not necessarily, because part of the joy of and the brilliance of these books is we don't know what has happened. So I don't want to say that they are or aren't pandemic novels. But with any kind of post-apocalyptic book written during or after COVID-19, I always wonder how that influenced the story. So for your second book, Moon of the Turning Leaves, which was just recently published in the fall of 2023 in Canada and February 2024 in the US, how is that different from writing the first book, given what we've gone through?
Oh, it did have an influence for sure. I think with the first book, it was, you know, entirely my speculation as to what could happen if a blackout just, you know, put us all into upheaval. And it was really fun, you know, to think about the end of the world and the aftermath, and also to include that mystery, right? Because the cause of the blackout is never revealed in the first book. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it was my chance to look at how Indigenous people could reset their relationship with the land around them and maybe ultimately be liberated by this cataclysm, right? So that was all like fun, I guess, basically, to, you know, even though there's some heavy things that happened in the first book, it was just really interesting for me to imagine the future. But then I had the opportunity to explore and develop the sequel. And that really started picking up steam in late 2019. And I didn't sign the contract until March of 2020, a week before the pandemic declaration. Yeah. So this whole time, Rick Meyer, my editor, and I were talking about the story. I had always considered some sort of plague element, right? Because I always knew I was going to have to reveal the cause, because no one's going to want to read two whole novels and not know what happened, right? People would be pretty irritated if they got to the end of the second book and there were no answers in that sense. So the plan was always to like reveal the cause of the blackout and then the sort of domino effect of catastrophes after that. And a plague element was going to be a big part of that story. But as March 2020 rolled along, Rick and I had a conversation and I thought, you know, we should probably water down that plague element quite a bit. So we talked about other ways to sort of, you know, ramp up that tension, but also, you know, show a series of events that could, you know, trigger the collapse of society and civilization as we know it. But also emotionally, it was heavy. It was huge, you know, like going through that time for everybody was really difficult. Our second son was born in June of 2020. So that was like, you know, a salvation for us in some ways, my wife and I. But at the same time, you know, when you're writing the story about the end of the world and you're going through this mysterious upheaval in real life too, I really had to like find ways to, I guess, you know, balance out all that heaviness and really, you know, find ways to heal and you know, these therapeutic measures of imagining this futuristic end of the world and also the current, what we thought probably was the end of the world too at the same time, right? So, so it took a bunch of, you know, I guess therapeutic, you know, healing moments and really, in the end too, it was, writing the story was therapeutic too, though, right? Because ultimately there are some hopeful elements to it. And again, it's my imagination of what a future could be for our people.
Wow, that's really interesting. I definitely had like 2020 flashbacks reading Moon of the Crested Snow, especially. And I've read a lot of post-apocalyptic and pandemic fiction like in the last several years. But this series so far is really like, I think the first that deals with similar things that straddle like our own pre and post pandemic life as well. And something that was really hearing you say that now, just like this concept of like you experienced a version of rebirth with the birth of your son at the beginning of the pandemic. And then Evan even experiences a rebirth of sorts with the birth of his grandchild at the very beginning of the second one. I don't know if that's a spoiler, if I should say anything about that, but anyway, it's just interesting. I think, are those sort of emotional things, emotional elements? Were you like, was that an intentional choice as a writer, or were those reactions to like the world that we were also living in at the time?
I think it was a bit of both. And the birth scene at the start of Moon of the Turning Leaves, especially, that was intended from the outset. When I had, you know, the opportunity to write the sequel, I thought, I want to start it with a birth, because there's so much death in the first book. And although I talk all the time about renewal and regeneration and all these new opportunities, we don't really see like physical rebirth or renewal in the first book. So I thought, you know, a birth at the outset of part two is a good opportunity to hit the reset button and to ultimately try to convey a sense of hope and forward thinking in some ways. And around that time, of course, as mentioned, our second son was born. So that was very fresh in my mind, right? Mm-hmm. And as mentioned, that was such a huge moment for us as a family in terms of coping with the early months of the pandemic. So it was a bit of both. And I think it really encouraged and invigorated me just to push forward with the story. And it's really challenging balancing all those things out, you know, in real life and in fiction. But I think writers wrestle with that all the time. Totally. You know, there's so much from our real lives that influence the fiction we're writing. And, you know, it can be hard to separate the two at times, yeah. Right? But that's part of the process, I think. And really, that's the beauty of creativity and the privileges mm-hmm. we have to have these platforms.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned when you were sort of summarizing the books, which is something about the tone of Moon of the Crusted Snow, which I just found so fascinating, because you mentioned these characters do live in such an isolated area that initially they don't know that anything has happened to society more broadly. They just know that something has happened, you know, to turn off the electricity in their community. And in these kinds of books, so much of the curiosity for readers is about finding out what happened. Mm. But for these characters, the story was much more about the idea that it doesn't necessarily matter what happened, just that something did, and we'll worry about that later. But right now we need to survive the coming winter. So as a writer, did you know, as you were writing that first book, what happened beyond the community in order to focus on how they survived that time?
Yeah, I had a pretty solid idea of what I wanted the cause of the blackout to be. And I did purposely kept it a secret, though, for the sake mm-hmm. of intrigue. But also, as you mentioned, to really look inwards and put the spotlight mm-hmm. on the community itself. Because, you know, when you come from a colonized or displaced people, you're already out of sight and out of mind, right? So to be cut off from the world to the south would not be unusual for these people. They would say, okay, mm-hmm. we're being left behind again anyway. So Let's just do what we're used to and focus on ourselves mm-hmm. and our own health and our happiness and our safety and so on, right? So in that sense, I don't think that's outside the realm of possibility that these people would be cut off and then, you know, automatically shift gears to just keep everybody surviving, right? And I think if you look at the history of cataclysmic events and colonization, I think really self-containing is a trait of a lot of indigenous communities to ensure that things can thrive and survive the whatever the latest onslaught mm-hmm. of brutality is, whether it's like natural or social or economic mm-hmm. or whatever else, right? So it was easy for me to detach from the actual cause in that sense. And I never told anybody what I envisioned the cause to be. I didn't even tell my wife, right? Because I thought if I start, you know, mentioning this in events or interviews, like people are going to draw their own conclusions. And then, you know, I think more solidly define what they think the end would be here and whether the response of this community is realistic or not, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to keep that separate. But as mentioned, you know, by the time I got into the second one, I mm-hmm. felt like I had to explore mm-hmm. the cause and more of the aftermath of that. I find it's, in my opinion, I think a natural response to just say, okay, we're already cut off. We're already removed mm-hmm. from society. You know, we don't necessarily need those things, those luxuries, those technologies mm-hmm. or whatever else. We have the skills to survive. So let's just focus on ourselves.
Going off that a little bit, I also really loved just how much is it sort of intentionally unknown in these stories and how long they're unknown for. And readers and critics have called Moon of the Crested Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves sort of slow burns. And I think that's really fair. But I also think it kind of redefines what a slow burn story can do. Because ultimately, like we've been saying, it doesn't matter how much I, the reader, knows what happened to the world. What matters is like how the characters are reacting to it. Mm-hmm. But I am curious, were there earlier drafts of these stories where you did reveal more, or there was more given to the readers? And especially because the first book is pretty short, like it mm-hmm. the pacing is like pretty it doesn't let up in a way that is like, I still don't know what happened. This is wild. Mm-hmm. So are there earlier drafts where you were like, okay, this is what happened?
Not in Moon of the Crested Snow. I think my original idea for that was to have this community just experience this blackout and then, you know, not have any answers and then just focus on themselves, right? And my original idea was for it to be a short story. And the blackout was the main source of tension. You know, I guess that was the antagonist. But the more I thought about it, you know, it was more intriguing to have like a stranger come in and then, you know, that become the bigger conflict, right? Mm-hmm. But I did feel like I had to reveal something. And having the two young guys come up from college, from the city, I think sort of fills in some of those gaps a bit. Yeah. And I thought that was necessary, you know, like in a post-apocalyptic novel, like people are expecting scenes of destruction or chaos or whatever else. So they're getting this sort of secondhand account from these guys who are already down there, right? And in the second story, I think there was a little more revealed that Rick and I scaled back a bit. And I think that was more or less for the sake of pacing and space, because the first draft was way longer than the final version, like something like 123,000 words, right? And the final printed version is something like 88,000. So yeah, there are things. Wow. Yeah, we did a lot of cutting for sure.
Yeah.
there are things that we cut back, mostly for the sake of pacing, but also, I mean, part of the appeal for some readers of the first book is that mystery, and because in the second book they're coming back into the world of the South more than a decade after the events, and you know they're still only getting secondhand accounts from people who survived that, right? So they're basically trying to piece together what happened, and they're unsure if they can believe everything or not. But there are some, like, there is some physical evidence along the way that of what has happened, you know, like the maps of like the poisoned areas and this recounts of the sick people and so on, right? So I would say there was a little too much detail in the early drafts of the second one that were cut for sure.
Interesting.
That's fascinating. Do you have plans to do anything with some of those words that you've cut, like make a short story? You know, is it something that it just extra details for this one, or could it be another short story connected to this world?
I never throw away what I cut, you know.
Really?
I'll keep the original drafts, or I'll copy and paste what's cut into a separate file if I think something's interesting. And Rick gave me a really cool idea for an adjacent story that I won't mention in case it doesn't happen anytime soon.
Sure.
But it was based on part of those sort of parallel stories, right? That you know they get from other people. So maybe that could live again on the page. Yeah.
Very cool.
Neat. So because that first book was about figuring out how to survive in the immediate aftermath of being cut off from the electricity and computers and food deliveries, an obvious focus of a follow-up book would be, you know, about getting back to life the way it was before. Like, that's what other post-apocalyptic novels do. They want to figure out what happened and how can we get back to that way of life. But the quest of this second story is absolutely not that, and it's one of my favorite aspects of this book. They've gone back to the way of like living with the land and working with it the way their ancestors lived. Then they're thriving in a way. So the quest is about sustaining that way of life. Could you talk to us about that choice and how you decided what that way of life 10 years on would look like for this community and for, you know, they encounter a couple of other communities as they are on their quest, and what those communities and way of life looked like?
I always saw the overall story as like a love letter to the lands, an impassioned sort of revelation about the potential for engaging with the natural world around us and how it can potentially sustain us as human beings, right? And that sort of idea gets lumped into indigenous ways of thinking nowadays, which they are, of course, but I always try to remind people that every civilization, every society around the world comes from an agrarian background, right? We mm-hmm. all come from the land. All of our ancestors have known how to, you know, harvest foods, create shelter, you know, create safety with our natural surroundings, right? And it's only been like 200, 300 years that we've all been, you know, removed from that with the advent mm-hmm. of industry and technology and so on, right? So, yeah, it really was an opportunity to, I think, highlight, you know, the potential and fostering a good relationship with the land around us for everybody. And of course, mm-hmm. it comes from an Anishinaabe perspective, because that's who I am, right? And you know, I grew up in the bush, and I live in Northern Ontario now, very close to the natural world around me. And I think, on the other hand, too, you know, land is something that needs to be respected and even feared at some points, which we see in parts mm-hmm. of Moon of the Turning Leaves too. So I didn't want the land just to be a backdrop or just a setting. I wanted it to be a force that influences the characters and the overall plot. And as they sort of navigate, you know, this homeland that's also foreign to them, they get to know that again, you know, as people mm-hmm. who are isolated, not by their choice initially, mm-hmm. but then ultimately for their own survival, what they fell upon in terms of a new routine, right, in their new era. But moving out of that and trying to resettle where they were originally from is a sort of re-engagement, is a resetting of that relationship, but also like how careful and how precious that can be mm-hmm. too. You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, filling up a backpack and walking into the bush. You have to know what you're getting into, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to really understand what the safe havens are and what the threats also are in the world mm-hmm. around you. So, it was really important for me to try to highlight that, not just as an Indigenous person, but as a human being.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. How did you decide which characters were going to be the ones to go on this quest for the second book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that was probably the biggest development element that I really mm-hmm. put a lot of thought into. You know, of course it was going to be Evan because yeah. he's you know, the main character in the first one. And I always thought, you know, it would be great because we're, you know, 10 years on from the end of the first book that his kids are going to be teenagers now. So it'd be great to have one of them go with him. And like, I guess the immediate thought is the son, Mayingun, to go with him. And it'd be like a father-son adventure story, right? And immediately I wasn't interested in that at all. You know, it seemed like a trope to me. Mm-hmm. And that story's been done. Mm-hmm. And I just thought people wouldn't be as interested in it being a buddy story, you know, dad and his boy go on this quest to save their people kind of thing, you know? So I thought, okay, I'll make Mayingun the son become a dad early on. You know, mm-hmm. he's the father of the baby girl who's born right at the beginning.
It's a beautiful first chapter, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks. Yeah. And so that leaves the door totally open for Nungos, the daughter, who at this point has become like one of the expert hunters, you know, one of the most skilled people from the community on the land, and she'll go with him, you know, and that really, I think, I don't know, when I considered that, it just felt so, I think, not just wholesome, but natural to me.
Sure.
And I also thought, you know, it's my responsibility as a dad to three boys to create a strong female lead, not just for them to read, but for everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. So that was really exciting. And when I came to that, I felt like it was just a matter of rounding out the rest of the group. So Tyler, he's one of the buddies from the first book. He'd be back. And then a really minor secondary character from the first book who only really has one mention, JC, he would be part of the group because of his, you know, he's older than the rest of them, and he's mm-hmm. got more knowledge and stories and so on. And then two other younger people who aren't part of the first story, Cal and Amber, who I think round out that sort of younger dynamic of the group, mm-hmm. and you know, highlight this new generation that's grown up in this new era and what they can offer to a quest like this. So it was really fun figuring out the group for sure.
Speaking of that, you know, figuring things out. When did you, at what point in the writing process did you figure out that you needed to jump so far ahead in time from the first book?
I think pretty early when I was conceptualizing what a part two could be. I think, you know, when I was mulling over the potential storylines, you know, the first one that comes to mind is, you know, pick it up right after the end of the first book, you know, right. What happens next, right? Right away. But to me, that sort of took on the same kind of tone and atmosphere and was essentially the same kind of story as the first one, sure. You know, just it was still the immediate aftermath of the cataclysm, right? And I wanted to try something different just to show farther into the future and to be more speculative on my end, you know, to make it, I guess, more bona fide speculative fiction, you know, think about what the world would be 12 years after the end. And again, as mentioned, it was a chance to highlight the younger generation, you know, the people who grew up in this new era, how they saw the world, the values that they developed as a result of that, and also the skills that they were able to revitalize, you know, being based on the land. So it seemed like it was more challenging for sure, because there was a lot I had to consider and build, and a lot of my original notes I had to consult to figure out how to create this new group, this new community, this new objective, and so on. But it was more exciting than anything else for sure.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Evan's daughter, Nengonz, as one of the main characters of the second book, and she was such a wonderful character to follow, because she was so young when the world as we know it, as the readers know it, fell apart. So she doesn't remember the things that, like, we, the readers, take for granted. So when she's on this quest, she's experiencing, you know, seeing a city for the first time, or encountering humans outside of her community for the first time, not knowing what a gas pump is. And it's such a fascinating way of looking at the world. It's like the older people in her group are afraid because what they can remember what could be out there. But for her, it's the fear of the unknown, but this curiosity, too. Could you talk more about how you approached writing her character?
Yeah, I'd love to. In the first draft of the story, I always had both Evan and Nungos as, I guess, the two main points of view, right? And in the first draft, it was Evan for pretty much the first half of the story, with Nungo still there, very present, obviously, having input and so on. But she sort of took more of a, I think, leadership role in the second half. And I think I'd written her perspective more strongly in the second half, right? But Rick, my editor, said, you know, like, try to bring her point of view in a little stronger, a little earlier for that world building element of it. And it made the most sense to me, too, because as they're like going through the land and as they're coming into new communities and so on, it's all foreign to her. Right. And it's all both mesmerizing and also, you know, a little fear invoking for her in some ways, but she's just so comfortable on the land that, you know, she's able to, I think, recognize what these things are eventually and what her responsibility to these things are at the same time too, right? And most importantly, what her responsibilities to the group are. So it was a chance to highlight her as a young leader. But yeah, for the world building element, it was really fun. You know, like, she's never seen train tracks before. She doesn't know what pizza is. She goes and sees billboards with like weird numbers and letters on them. And you know, different kinds of faces that she could have never imagined before and so on. So it was pretty fun to try to paint that picture through her eyes and really just see ultimately what matters, you know?
Yeah.
And not to like infantilize it or, you know, hint at like the primitivity of their group, but at the same time is what matters. And, you know, websites, cell phones, train tracks don't matter to her. It's the natural world around her, and that's how she survived, and that's how she's going to help lead her community into further survival.
Yeah, I really loved her. I don't have a question about this, but more just like, I just loved the way that she sort of represented the last generation that exists in both worlds, and that even though her memories are really blurry when everything happened, like, they still happen to her too. And I do think that straddling that line of like pre and post end of world is a little bit her superpower.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the time jump for a second, because I think making such a big time jump was kind of a stroke of genius. Because you mentioned already, like, a lot of these sorts of books, the sequels pick up right where the first one, or the one before it, left off. But with a 12-year jump like this, the reader, me, we experience this false sense of security a little bit of like, okay, a lot of time has passed. A certain amount of healing has happened. Everything seems pretty okay. Everyone seems pretty happy considering. And I think that adds to some of the heartbreak of the moments that happen in the second book without giving away anything. Because you're just thinking like, no, like, they've come so far. This can't happen right now. It feels really unfair, but it's sort of also inevitable. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question for you as the writer is, how much did you consider those 12 unwritten years as you wrote the second book? Like, did the experiences off the page influence any of their experiences on the page?
I think so. That's a big gap in time to fill in mentally and creatively, right? And it was really challenging to figure out, you know, how much of that context do I include without really bogging the story down or really, I think, boring the reader. Mm-hmm. And I think readers of stories like this like those details. But at the same time, there's a new objective that these characters have, and they have to move on, right? They can't really dwell on the past too much. But at the same time, they're still carrying heavy baggage of trauma, not just of the recent blackout, but their history as colonized peoples, you know, that have endured ongoing brutality of the state and so on. So I think that's where a lot of the apprehension comes from for the older characters. It's like, okay, we survived this latest thing and we're good without, you know, the rest of the world, but reality sort of starts creeping in on them, and that, you know, they do have to move on at some point. So it becomes, you know, they're triggered by different things along the way, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, how I would approach that kind of quest myself if I put myself in these shoes. You know, what am I carrying with me emotionally and mentally? Mm-hmm. And what do I really need to reconcile? Not just within myself, but within my family and my community, who, you know, are depending on our ultimate exodus if we're able to, I think, prolong our lives as people, as human beings, you know? So, yeah, I think there's some hints of those traumas as they're walking. And of course, I didn't want to, like, you know, try to convey these people as ultimately utopic, right? And that was the other question I had to answer too about writing a part two. Is like, okay, these people were able to renew their old ways, but is it utopia for them? And utopia is such a subjective term for everybody anyways, you know? Some of the settlements they come to maybe could be considered utopian, but at the same time, they're still carrying the baggage of the past, right? And I think with, you know, the as the generations develop and these intergenerational relationships form, I think those traumas would be resolved or would be healed after time. And then maybe that's how you get to a utopia. I don't know. But that's sort of something I wanted to leave the readers with, is like, you know, what is the ultimate outcome for people who have survived so much apocalypse over and over and over again? But at this point, it's still, you know, even though it's 12 years after the end, it's still pretty fresh, right? And the recent history for them is still pretty fresh too. And that really is ultimately that traumatic baggage that they still have to deal with.
Do you plan, I mean, you already mentioned this a little bit, but mentioning like the other communities they happen upon and this 12-year gap between books, it does feel like there is a lot of potential for like other stories within this world, like or prequel stories or stories within the years that pass. Do you have any plans to sort of expand this universe and make it more stories?
Not right away, but I think, you know, the potential is there, and and it's exciting, you know, when you mention that or when I hear that from other people. I think immediately, though, I need to like step away from this world because I've been like mired in the post-apocalypse for the last almost 10 years. But I do want to write something a little more joyful, a little happier for the next novel. But, you know, like being in this world, And sharing it with readers who are so enthusiastic about it has been the greatest gift. Like, honestly, yeah. there would not be a part two without the readers of part one, because they never considered a part two at all.
Wow.
So when people said, you know, we want more, we want to see what happens after a while, I thought, you know, what a blessing that is for me. What a privilege. Yeah. So I owe that to the readers, and I owe that to the characters in the story especially. So to jump back in, yeah, would be awesome. And I definitely hope to do that one day. In terms of a part three, yeah, I think there may be enough for a part three, but also an adjacent story, as you mentioned. Yeah. I think there's something else in the world that I could hopefully tap into.
I do just want to say really quickly that, like, you mentioned, like, I think something that is kind of lovely about these books too is that there is like a surprising amount of joy in them, because like they are such a close group of people and community that, like, it made, like, if I was feeling any amount of intentional anxiety, like, they are so lovely to one another, and they also like hold each other in a state of like, I trust you a lot, so like I'm also going to be really honest with you. Was a lovely thing about these books, because like, while the world around it is incredibly dire, their love for one another was like rooted me in like, okay, I can do this too.
Thank you. Cool. Yeah.
So I was reading your bio on your website and in the back of the books, and saw that you are also a journalist. And I wondered how that work has influenced your fiction writing.
Oh, a lot. You know, I haven't worked full time as a journalist in almost 4 years now. I quit my job at CBC when I had the opportunity to write this story. And the main reason was I wanted to put as much effort into it as possible. And also other factors too, like the pandemic. You know, I was really not enthused about doing a pandemic story every day for however many years to come, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think working as a journalist has been one of the greatest, I think, fortunes of my literary career. I have, you know, had the opportunity to meet so many people in so many places, in so many different scenarios, over the last, you know, 20 plus years, that I've had a pretty good understanding of humanity and how people respond to certain situations, who they are, what their objectives are for themselves, their families, their communities, and so on. And I think that really helps me, you know, drill down to the essence of humanity when I'm writing fictional characters. And that's not to say that I'll take the real experiences of real people and write about them in fiction, but I'll have a better understanding of how people just live in the world, you know, because I've been able to meet so many people. So that's been the greatest benefit, I think, of my journalism career on my fiction career. At the same time, like, the organizational skills definitely help too.
Yeah,
because when you're on a daily deadline for the news, you have to have everything planned out very, I think, efficiently. And you have to hit that deadline, or else, you know, you're not an effective journalist. You won't have a job for too long if you can't hit those deadlines, right? So, you know, adapting that approach to writing fiction has been pretty helpful for me too, just in terms of like organizing, you know, different things, like just the narrative structure to character profiles to the research and so on. And then setting the time to write different drafts and do different revisions by different times too. I think that has really helped me. And you know, it's an approach that I plan to apply to fiction writing as long as I do it.
Yeah, it's worked so far.
Thanks.
So you said you wanted to take a break from this series. Are you... this may be far too soon, and feel free to say if it is, what are you working on next? And I think I saw something about you. Are you involved in a mentorship program for other writers?
Oh yeah, I'm involved in a couple different mentorship programs. That is like some of the, you know, some of my favorite work to do, because you know, I don't come from a literary background educationally or professionally. I had mentors who were writers who really helped me understand storytelling in this way and really get to know the industry, which is hugely important too when you're not exposed to it. So I see it as my, obligation to widen the circle for as many aspiring writers as possible. So yeah, I'm involved in a few different mentorships and, you know, whatever insights I can share with people, I'm always happy to, because, the more people we bring into this method of storytelling, the better, right? In terms of the next book, I am starting to write something that, is more or less like a day in the life of a reserve. It's more about like the day-to-day realities and in a sort of joyful way. I'm still sort of like fine tuning the plot. So I don't want to say exactly what it is yet, but, there is a definite, mood, that I want to get across with it and a different sort of, a definite sort of celebratory tone, just about, you know, our present realities. Right. And not necessarily using like the post-apocalypse to try to do that, you know, to show that those things happen still to sure. this day, you know, despite what people may see in the media or, you know, the stereotypes that continue to exist, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It has been such a pleasure. I'm a huge fan. Please make sure that you or your publicist keep us informed of the next book, because want to make sure that we are able to tell people about it. In the meantime, where can people find you if they want to learn more?
First, I just want to say, Chmigwech, big thanks to you both, Amy and Michael. This has been just such a pleasant conversation, and I really love taking a deeper dive into some of these writing elements. So thanks for your great questions. Yeah. People can find me at my website. It's just waub.ca, waub.ca. But I'm also on social media. I'm on Instagram at waub, at waub. You can find me on Facebook under my full name, Waub Gijik Rice. And I'm also on Twitter/X at Waub, at WAUB as well.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to Writer's Digest Presents. Join us next month for the first episode in our series about writing emotions. Until then, you can always find us at writersdigest.com and on social media at Writer's Digest. See you next time.